What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guests today are Tom Weiner and Dr. Amilcar Shabazz. Tom Weiner is a Northampton-based writer, educator, and anti-racism activist. He taught third through sixth grade at the Smith College Campus School for 40 years and middle and high school summer school for 34 years. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Great to be here. Thanks for the reminder.
I'm glad to have you. Amilcar Shabazz is a professor in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the treasurer and former president of the National Council for Black Studies. His writing has appeared in books, academic journals, and magazines. Good morning.
Peace and blessings. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you both. Their book, y'all, that we are discussing today is In Defiance, 20 Abolitionists You Were Never Taught in School. All right, let's hop right in because there's a lot to hop into. I will say that I appreciated the politics before the stories, right? So I do a lot of interviews and people highlight, you know, folks that have not been spoken about, but usually they hop right into, right, this is so-and-so and here's their story, as opposed to giving us context, which I think you all do quite beautifully in the book. But let's start with an impulse. Tom, how long have you been working on this book and why were you driven to tell these stories?
Well, the inspiration for the book came from my starting teaching and wanting to teach people like this to my students, and I could not find sources. So I made the decision 45 years ago that this book had to get written, and then waited till about 6 years ago to start writing it. And that impetus came from finally having been retired for a few years, finishing another book, and having this one waiting on the back burner, yelling and calling to me, as I describe in the preface, was done to the woman who inspired me to finally get started, Kathy from the African American History Museum in Donelson, Kathy Hambrick. She heard her ancestors calling her and saying, "Don't let them forget us," after she'd been on the plantation tours and only talked about servants. That was it for me. That was like the final straw of saying, "Get going on this book." And Kathy was an inspiration, as was the African proverb on the desk in the African American History Museum where I met her that said, "Until the lion," and yesterday Jonetta Cole, former president of Spelman College, told me it should say, "Until the lion and the lioness tell the tale, tales of the hunt will glorify the hunter." This is the book to glorify the lion and the lioness, and it's been waiting to be written for 45 years.
That's actually one of my favorite proverbs. Use it a lot in the work that I do as well. Dr. Shabazz, how did the two of you come together and what was the ignition point for you two to work with each other on this book?
Yes, for me in many ways, I'm the other side of the coin in that going to middle school and high school in the 1970s, I guess the teachers had no resources either, because I got absolutely nothing in my entire K-12 education about Black, anybody doing anything historically significant that was Black. I went to an all-Black elementary, all-Black middle school, and about the only person I can recall, and I guess she did it surreptitiously, not even in the curriculum, Langston Hughes. I got a little bit of the poetry of Langston Hughes. But other than that, we got nothing. In high school, we got a little bit about Dr. King. They had me in the first ever Black history event in my high school. I went to an integrated, so-called integrated Catholic high school. They asked me to read some excerpts of the I Have a Dream, the March on Washington speech. So, you know, that's my own background. I didn't start learning anything about any Black figures in history or white abolitionists or anything like that. And I grew up in Texas. So this is where the textbooks are made. It's in that Texas market that the American schools textbooks are made. So I don't think it's changed a whole lot even since then, despite all the Black studies and all the work we've been doing. The actual state curricula and the actual training of teachers to be able to do much is still so limited. When they come to me in college, they say, oh, all I ever heard about in school was Rosa Parks refusing to get up on the bus and Dr. King. Maybe they heard a little bit about a Malcolm X just on the side somewhere from hip hop music or something. So it's this is the context. It's still going on 2025 in this country. And so Tom and I met through an intergroup dialogue process that we were both got involved with. And he mentioned, you know, his interest in this kind of work and this project. And so as we grew to know each other, we talked about collaborating to make this happen. And so here we are.
I have the same question for you both, but I'm going to ask you to answer it in a little bit different ways. And I'm tugging on a thread that Dr. Shabazz just put forward, right? So I come from the world of education advocacy. That's where I first cut my teeth on as an organizer in South Central. And one of the things that we know, right, is it is crucial to the healthy development of children. I'll talk about Black children in particular, to see people that look like them, to learn about their history, to feel like they belong in the conversation that is happening inside the classrooms. And feeling that kind of alienation, right, can have direct impacts on the experience, academic outcomes, life outcomes, et cetera. So Tom, as a lifelong educator, I'm wondering if you can speak to that a little bit, because I think it gives more context for the importance of this book and where this book should be. And then Dr. Shabazz, I'd love for you, like on a little bit more of a personal note, right, like how not having access to those narratives impacted your worldview. So Dr. Shabazz can mull over that while Tom answers the first part of the question.
Yeah, I felt that these people and people of their experience and background needed to be in the curriculum for the reasons you just gave, but not just for the Black students. I feel the same way about integration isn't just for Black students. Certainly, it's imperative that we recognize that having segregated schools has the worst impact on students of color. But this is the lift all boats kind of experience. White students desperately need to know the capacities, contributions. The unit I had in my classroom where I had that African proverb at the bottom of the bulletin board was called African American Contributors to American Culture. And that was a concept that never occurred in my elementary school experience. I start out the unit I taught of this subject with telling them that I got the second highest score in a Black history pretest when I got to UMass. And they're all guessing 86, 92, you know, they're just assuming that I must have had a really good score. And I tell them the second highest score was 22%. And that was me having gone a little bit out of my way in high school to get to Langston Hughes, to hear some music by jazz composers that were Black. And it still got a 22%. So the need was dire, starting in the beginning of my career in the early 70s. And it never went away. And the Black students who I taught, both in the campus school and especially in summer school, were getting to be exposed to Black writers, Black playwrights, because I wanted them to know that they had people who were role models and who were achievers who did not get the credit they were deserving. And I wanted my white students to know this isn't a white world. There are people that are achieving unbelievably extraordinary accomplishments, from Charles Drew inventing the blood transfusion to Matthew Henson getting to the North Pole and on and on and on, so that they would have an expanded worldview and not just see the world through very white colored lenses.
Thank you, Tom. Dr. Shabazz.
Yeah, for me, I think on the personal note, it started setting me up in a way of wanting to know when are the institutions that I'm attending, what, you know, holding them to account, some accountability. When are y'all going to bring this stuff into the curriculum, make it relevant, and for all of us, for me and all my classmates to benefit from? So, you know, Tom is right. Now, I didn't get anything in school, but You know, on the side, we had Ebony magazine coming into my house, Jet magazine. We had the Budweiser posters that had all the great kings of Africa. You know, I'd go to the barber shop and he'd have the Budweiser poster up, and I'd sit there, you know, while I'm waiting for my cut, half an hour or whatever, you know, reading and studying these things. So I did a lot of things on the side. I wasn't completely nothing, but I'm saying the school institutions, what's their responsibility to me, to my classmates, white, black, otherwise, to have these figures of history be a part of what we're learning? And so so it really made me feel very, you know, awkward about these institutions. And but ultimately, you know, I came to commit a good part of my life to working within them. So I went and I did a master's degree in history. My undergrad degree was in economics, but I did a master's in history. And I wrote a thesis about the school that I was attending, how it came to be racially integrated, because it had been a segregated school in Texas. And as I did the research, I come to find it was my mother and father were among the first 26 Black students to enter that school in 1956. This is the same year that Arthurine Lucy attempted to integrate the University of Alabama, and all hell broke loose, and Thurgood Marshall had to come and take her out of there and bring her up to New York City for safety because she couldn't continue going to school there. The Klan was going to kill her. That same fall, that was February of 56, that same fall of 56 in East Texas, my mother and father a part of desegregating Lamar State College of Technology. And many of the whites in that area tried to create a crisis situation, as happened in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. They picketed, they turned over cars when Black people would ride up to go to class. They pulled people, you know, to the out of cars who were trying to go to school. My mother evaded it. She never had an ugly incident. But these are the things that would happen, that happened, that nobody would talk about. No one, when I interviewed my own parents and others, why didn't y'all raise us with any of these stories about what y'all had done? Oh, we wanted you all, you know, if things were going to change, we wanted you all to approach integrated situations with white folks, you know, with a fresh slate, without all this baggage, because, you know, we wanted you to be able to get along, you know, well in the integrated. So we didn't want to burden you all with all these kind of stories. You see? So then I went on to write a dissertation that went beyond that one institution. I did all of the institutions in Texas and how they came to be racially integrated. And then I've gone on from there to continue kind of working in that area. So, and I've been teaching ever since, over almost 40 years now in higher ed. So I became kind of committed to making that accountability happen. And this book with Tom is also, you know, at a more of a grassroots level, that kind of accountability as well.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. I'm in conversation with Tom Weiner and Dr. Amilcar Shabazz. They have a new book out called In Defiance, 20 Abolitionists You Were Never Taught in School. I'm diverting from my scripture for a second. And as Dr. Shabazz was describing, right, those scenes of integration that took place in the 50s in the South, and the violence and the upset of white folks, or even think about like what books were and were not accessible, right? I think maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, that would have seemed like such a distant, right, that happened then. Howsomever. As you were talking, I was like, that could be tomorrow. We already have books banned. Your book would not be allowed into many schools, and not just in the South, right? We're seeing this ugliness pop up in the North, just like slavery was not just in the South. So I don't know if Dr. Shabazz, if you could reflect on that, and then Tom, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
So here's the rub. Ever since George Floyd was killed in 2020, and we had a moment of so-called racial reckoning, like my friend and comrade Malina Abdullah says, you know, there was this big racial reckoning.
Hold on now. What? That's my sister from another mister.
We can folk already.
All right, there we go.
But, you know, she points out that it then all seemed to kind of want to evaporate. and people, you know, go back to sleep or whatever, and now call being woke a bad word. But since 2021, 40 Republican legislators have introduced bills in 44 states to limit teaching of anything of race and racism in American schools. 44 states. 18 of them have approved those bills, such as Alabama, where a former colleague of mine, good comrade sister, Cassandra Simon, is the lead and plaintiff in a lawsuit challenging that bill that has been passed and signed into law that bans teaching so-called divisive subjects. That's all they define it as, divisive. So somebody just rats you out, oh, they said such and such in class, and then they can say you taught something divisive and fire you. This is Alabama now. So we have that in 18 states out of the 44 that have legislation, and those that out of that 44, the others that haven't yet, they still continue to bring those up. Our state of Massachusetts is part of the five or six states that have no such, that have introduced no such legislation since 2021 to restrict teaching on race or racism. But this is the climate we're in. This is what people will have to come out and say, hey, we're not with that if we're going to beat those efforts back.
Tom, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, the back cover tells the story. It says, in defiance is a corrective. American history has historically suffered from the systematic effort of many in power to suppress the story of those whose lives serve as models for those who came after, models of conscience, activism, and dedication to the cause of abolition of enslavement in our case. That's what's happening. That's what we're up against. And that's why this book, you've already said, maybe it wouldn't even be allowed in some school districts or states even. And that's why we wrote it. I mean, that's why it's coming out now, the timing. We didn't think when we were getting it ready to be published that this level of repression, oppression, authoritarian, name it, would be happening. Maybe some of us foresaw it after 7 months of the dictatorship, but this is what we're dealing with. So we're going around to libraries and schools and bookstores
And here's the thing. And we took 20 abolitionists, as we call them, and we didn't do all 20 as Black people. We're trying to show in there it's 10 and 10, 10 white and 10 Black. So it's not saying all white people are bad, all white people are oppressors, we should hate all white people. This is what they try to indoctrinate about people to be against Black history and Black studies. This is not the case. We're showing that the white and Black and working together to make these change, to make change. So there's none of that critical race theory propaganda is relevant to our book In Defiance.
Tom, actually, I was going to ask you to tug on that thread in a separate question, but there was this process of where white folks fit inside of this book, how to tell their stories and center those most impacted. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Actually, I have to give my children credit for having it not just be a book about white people. Because at the beginning, I was thinking, boy, this is a time when white young people need to see white people standing up for Black people. Because we were getting the fade of the stand-up that George Floyd's death caused. So I'm thinking, here's another reason. But they said, not a good time to center white people. And so the whole thing switched to being balanced. Five Black women, five Black men, five white women, five white men, very, very intentionally. And then I started seeing there were people also going back earlier than I ever thought. So we have Daniel Pistorius, 1688, the Germantown anti-slavery petition, way before I thought things were really cranking up. And he's the first chapter of the white people. Black people are in the first half of the book. And our first Black person is Belinda Sutton, who sued for reparations in 1783, way before reparations was something that anybody thought was on the on front page. So it became really important to have this range of people, range of time periods. So we really gone from the late 1600s to 1863, at least. And then we take some of them past the Civil War. So it's a good 200 almost year spread. And we wanted it to be able to attract the interest and the investment of all different people, of different races, of young people, high school and college. So that was majorly in the thinking and the selection process.
You just opened up a bunch of doors there for that we can walk through in terms of the next part of our conversation. So I think then where we'll go now is setting some context for the time period, right? Those 200 years, and particularly the peculiar institution of slavery that set the political context from which the folks that are in this book could emerge. Dr. Shabazz, you want to you utilize David Walker and what he proffered. That's how you do it in the book, but you feel free to answer that any which way you choose.
Sure. So I would just say that we expand the traditional concept of abolitionism far beyond just looking at the folks between like the 1820s or 1830s down to the Civil War. We look at abolitionists as those who fought to end slavery, to abolish slavery, to free the enslaved. So that takes us all the way back to the beginning of this whole slavery, enslavement and slave trade process. So that's where we can go back to the 1600s, the 1700s, and not just that little period in the 1800s. I'm about to sneeze, so I'll pitch it over to Tom.
We have the person who I credit with starting a guerrilla theater in 1738, Benjamin Lay. They just did a play about him in Philadelphia last month. Just, I felt like I was bringing him out of obscurity. I'd never heard of him. Now someone wrote a play about him, but he was 4'10" tall, a Quaker, as many of them were, and he introduced an incredible guerrilla theater performance by walking into Quaker meeting wearing a greatcoat on all 4'10" of himself, having a sword inside the coat, a Bible, and inside the Bible, a pig's bladder filled with red dye. And at a certain moment in the service, to dramatize that there were Quakers who were firm believers in the golden rule, do unto others, etc., they were having slaves. They enslaved people. So he would take a moment in the service, open up the coat, take his sword, plunge it into the pig's bladder, splatter all those people nearby, and say to them, "You are destroying the lives of people of color, black people, and you are hypocrites, all of you, preaching one thing and practicing another." So this is 1738, and we get guerrilla theater. So we really want it, like the Dr. Shabazz is saying, expand the narrative, make it more inclusive, include this huge range of time. Think about it. That's almost as long as there's been a country. And then we're going back to 1688 and really earlier in Dr. Shabazz, what he did in the first chapter. And we're saying all of this is what was the foundation and the background for what people were saying, enough, and not in my name, and I'm going to make this stop. And a big part of this, I want to add, in addition to the political part and the social part, was the education part. People like Anthony Benezet, who was doing education for black young people. Robert Morris fighting for integrating Boston schools in the 1840s. And I'm reading a book by another incredible writer, Jennifer Reisinger, all about schooling the nation. We don't have her big time in our book. She's mentioned Prudence Crandall, starting a school for black high school girl, well, 9 to 18-year-olds in Canterbury, Connecticut, and having a backlash like what we're having now. People trying to snuff her out. People eventually setting fire to her school. 4 lawsuits to try to prevent these black girls from even being seen as educable. So that's another strand we follow through big time. And it's happening today. This book does not stop being relevant because it's ending in the 19th century. It's in many ways more relevant to me than ever.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Tom Weiner and Dr. Amilcar Shabazz. They have a new book out called In Defiance, 20 Abolitionists You Were Never Taught in School. Dr. Shabazz, picking up on the thread that Tom left there for us, what I thought about a lot was the evolution of the work of abolitionists, right? And the evolution of slavery in this country. You know, Angola sits on a plantation. We know that we've got the 13th Amendment. So if you could just reflect on that, and Tom, I'm going to turn to you to do the same thing. And people call me an abolitionist because of the work that I do to abolish the carceral state, yeah? And the roots of the carceral state, we all know, are in the legacy of slavery. So I also think that this book is super timely because the word abolition is now, one could almost say, mainstream. Like, whether it's being used as a boogeyman word, right? Or it's being utilized to have this larger conversation in terms of shifts that need to happen in our political, social, and cultural fabric.
Absolutely. The approach that some of the reviewers of our book have pointed out is that many of the individuals, the 20 that we present here, they don't all agree on the solutions to the evils of enslavement. Just like today, not everybody agrees on the solution to the prison industrial complex, the carceral state, and all these things. But nonetheless, we all have to find ways to oppose what is going on. And that's in defiance. That's what in defiance is about, is opposing these things that we take as the norm, sending, the 2 million people, us leading the world, I think, other than China, in the number of people of the population that we incarcerate, and most of that being black and brown bodies. So, that is definitely in common with what we're trying to get across. Is it's not like we're holding these 20 up that they all had the right answers, they all had the right solutions, they all agreed. It's not the case. We have, all the way from a woman that supported John Brown with money to violently work to overturn the slaveholders. Okay, Mary Ellen Pleasant. And we have all the way from her to others who were based more on, like, the law, the courts, and moral suasion, and more incremental change. So, again, wide differences in the tactics and the strategies, but the common commitment to saying, hey, we gotta defy this evil, this injustice that's going on. That's what we're that's that for me is, I think, the crux of what we're trying to get across in Defiance.
I would add, also, just finished an incredible book. I don't even think I've talked to Dr. Shabazz about it, and I tell him all the things I'm doing and reading, but it's called Bird Uncaged by Marlon Peterson, an abolitionist's freedom song. And it's his experience growing up in Brooklyn and ending up in prison on the high school to prison pipeline, and advocating through his prison experience to get rid of him, to promote healing and not punishment. And that would be the way the carceral state someday gets undone. So people don't see the goal of taking a person who has been traumatized generationally and suffering all the indignities of systemic racism and put him away so he doesn't bother us anymore. No, this book is so much more than that, so powerful. And it is exactly in keeping with what these abolitionists were doing in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. They were looking around and seeing people who were already suffering untold and indescribable horrors and saying, this has to end. This is not going to be a way out for this country to keep this up. And I feel the same way about the prison system. The carceral system in this country cannot, it's bursting, and it's going to explode. And it has exploded. Attica, and there's many, many examples of the explosions. And this book is saying, look at these 20 people. They were willing to put it all on the line to stop a horrific, hateful system. And I have enormous respect for them. We have the dedication, by the way, in the front of the book. The title speaks for itself, but we then take it one step further and say, to all those who defiantly and courageously sought freedom, justice, and equality then, and to those who continue to do so now. So this is what we feel the book hopefully will inspire for young people.
And again, giving room that that kind of defiance can come out in many ways. And for example, in the Sarah Mapp Douglas, we feature her artwork, her butterfly. What's the woman that we have her, the Oriole? And who is that, Tom?
It's the Graysana Oriole on the cover, named after Graysana Lewis, enormously important Underground Railroad woman.
So even with art, even with culture, even in music, in so many different ways, there are ways that we can resist. It's not all, you know, to arm struggle or you know, go in a march and demonstrate or file a lawsuit. They're just, we want to open the space for every form of resistance to be embraced.
I loved how Jonetta Cole said it yesterday. Don't let them steal our joy. We always have our joy. And she predicated it on a commitment to the arts. And that is part why we write books like this, why people sing the songs. They can't take that away. My quote on the bottom, my signature quote is from Sojourner Truth when I'm sending my emails. And the quote is very, very clear about the importance of holding on to these things that matter as much as they do. So when I write an email, mine says, life is a hard battle anyway. If we laugh and sing a little as we fight the good fight of freedom, it makes it all go easier. I will not allow my life's light to be determined by the darkness around me. Sojourner Truth.
I was just interviewing my friend, comrade, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. today, this morning. We were talking about, you know, what's happening in Chicago, and I'm now time dating this interview, but that's okay, because I'm guessing when this airs, there will still be things happening in Chicago, and or we will be talking about what happened in Chicago, even if this airs later. Something he says often, right? Everything is political. The music's political. He talks about a lot in The Fight to name the street after his assassinated father, right? Everything is political. The words, the colors we wear, everything. And I'll just one more thing. And I, people ask me, like, look, how do I get involved? What do I do? And I say all the time, I said, not everybody should go to 14th and Broadway. That's intersection of resistance here in Oakland, California, and get tear gassed. I can testify it tastes like garbage, right? That's not the role for all of us. But we need communicators. We need chefs. We need people to watch the babies. We need people to write the press releases. We need people to drive the cars. We need the medics. We need the healers. We need, right? So find what makes your heart sing in the darkness and do that. Yeah, like that's the assignment, I think, in this moment. Go ahead, Tom. Yeah.
Well, I think that's what Dr. Shabazz was saying about we got 20 people doing different things. You know, Delia is going around and freeing people, doing Underground Railroad stuff. I start the chapter with about her by talking about a woman who lived to be 100 in our valley, was an icon, Frances Crowe. And when they would ask her how many times he'd been arrested, she'd say, not enough. And is probably well over 200. So there's that method. There's the person who's the first Black woman to get her artwork published in a book, Sarah Mapps Douglas, that Dr. Shabazz mentioned. There's the first person to talk in front of the Supreme Court, John Stuart Rock. There were so many different methodologies. A lot of it was talk. Sarah Parker Ramon went all around this country, then took it to England and gave incredible speeches, inspiring mill workers in England to give money to the cause of abolishing freedom in America. So yeah, whatever the path is, and we have lots of different ways to get there that are demonstrated in this book. And I totally support you just touched the iceberg tip of listing all the different ways people can contribute. It's about waking up to the need. And the book is supposed to help that.
You know, one of the things we're seeing a lot of historians are writing about and people is just the idea of refusal. And the need to just refuse some of the madness and some of the things that are going on. And in that refusal is our defiance. And I think of someone like a Paul Jennings. And here's the man who is like the chief usher. I mean, the chief person in the White House of Madison and of the First Lady, Dolly Madison. This is when the White House is really coming into form as this grand space of the American Republic. And he's there making it all go. And so loyal to it that during the War of 1812, and the British are coming, they're all evacuating the White House and they're about to leave this portrait of George Washington. And it's Paul that goes back into the house to save the painting before the British would get there and burn the White House down, and all this kind of fear and panic. He's very loyal. He's very, you know, beloved. He will go on at some point to write his memoir about his days in the White House and all of that. But nonetheless, He is the one of the main leaders, conductors in an underground railroad effort that many people don't know, but is the largest single attempt of a mass escape in United States history. And this same Paul Jennings, who's like the man in the White House and so loyal to the Madisons and America, is the one that works to get these folks in this mass escape to leave Washington, D.C. on this ship, the Pearl, that becomes known as the Pearl Incident. So again, there's so many different kinds of stories, different kinds of acts of defiance that we want to, that we bring out in this book, that that the feedback we've gotten, especially from students, I've shared the book in some of my classes. We've developed study questions and resources we have on our website for those who want to read the book in that kind of fashion. But the students have been like, whoa, didn't know about the Pearl Incident. Whoa, I didn't know about, you know, the work of John Rock and his comments on how, you know, pioneering Black is beautiful and so on. We get really good feedback that some of these stories really hit home with people.
Tommy, 30 seconds for last comment.
Wow. Well, I'm super wanting to thank you, Kat, and the station for inviting us, and thank Hannah for making it happen, our publisher, just giving her a big call out because she's been monumental in getting our work into the world. And we want our work to get into the world. So now we made a West Coast premiere, a West Coast debut to have us being through Berkeley. And so we're greatly appreciative, and hopefully the stuff we've saying will resonate with people when they hear and see us. So big, big gratitude to you. Thank you to the station and to you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.